Float Originals. Hören, was auf dem Wasser bewegt. Mit Kerstin Zillmer.
Hi there. This is Float Originals, the podcast of Float Magazine. My name is Kerstin Zillmer. I'm reporting from Berlin. Welcome to this international episode in English, where I will be talking about the new finishing Vendée Globe 2020 with Andy Robertson, sailing journalist and presenter of the Vendée Globe magazine in English, and Dieke Ferry, the six-time circumnavigator and finisher of the Vendée Globe 2008. Hallo, liebe Float Originals, Hörerinnen und Hörer, herzlich willkommen zu dieser internationalen Folge der Float Originals und deshalb heute auf Englisch. Ich begrüße Andy Robertson, allen bekannt als der englische Moderator des täglich erscheinenden Vendée Globe Magazins, und Dieke Ferry, die sechsfache Weltumseglerin, die selbst 2008 an der Vendée Globe teilgenommen hat und für Float das Rennen um die Welt begleitete. Hi Andy, how are you?
Well, a very warm welcome to our last Vendée Globe Live. In fact, it's a podcast for Float in Germany, and I'm connecting today with Dieke Ferry. It's the evening just before the arrival of the last competitor in this Vendée Globe, Harry Husila. So thanks for joining us.
So Andy, you're a sailing journalist for many years now, and you started in print, but you've pretty much become the face of the Vendée Globe for the international audience. Every day, millions of people have tuned into your show and cheered the sailors along following the stories that you brought to life. Does it feel like this end, coming to the end of the race, is difficult for you now?
Well, for sure. I think it's difficult for me, but I think it's difficult for everyone. You know, we're still having many, many emails every day asking for all kinds of little pieces of information, you know. And I think it's just leaving such a void in people's lives. And of course, it's going to do the same for myself, you know. But it has been a long old job, you know, 115 days. I did 12 or 15 days before the start.
Well, for sure, you've pretty much invested more time than everybody else has sailing around the world. you pretty much, it feels to us that you're single-handedly being the international face of the Vendée Globe. Can you just give us a bit of insight? I mean, obviously there's a team. How is the media of the Vendée Globe organized? Give us a bit of a insight into the background.
Well, certainly in terms of the TV, I'm pretty much on my own a lot of the time in that I organize all of the show each day. So I organize the guests. I look at the videos that come in from the boats generally, and I then go to an editor and ask for either subtitles for the French pieces or for them to be edited down to different durations so they fit the show. But in general, then I go to the production people and say, right, this is what we're doing and this is the way it's going to run. But, you know, there's a huge disparity in terms of the resources and the international side and the French side. And the French side, they have a team of editors, they have a producer who's just producing the French show, and it's all runs like clockwork. And I always feel that we're always kind of chasing our tail a little bit on the international side, but we've had huge support from people like yourselves and all our guests have really been enthused by the whole thing, and it's you know, it works out. It's a different show to the French show for sure, and the truth is, there's many, many French people and fans have followed the English show as well, and some have preferred it. It's a little bit more hardcore. It's a little bit more informative, whereas on the French side, they're really looking for a broader audience. You know, they're looking for the family audience and the people who are coming to the Vendée Globe for the first time. But to be honest, we've achieved that as well. You know, it's the first time that we've had email feedback. Every day at the end of every show, or even in the evenings, as with the time differences, we've had people emailing in with, you know, congratulations or questions or just general feedback, and it's been hugely enjoyable and satisfying.
Yeah, nice. Back at the start of the race, some 100 odd days ago, it was never your intention to do 80 days worth of live shows, was it? So, what actually changed during the course of the race for you?
Well, I mean, there's two fundamental things. One was trying to find somebody who could do all the different components of the job, if you like. And we did have somebody lined up who then ended up going to work for the America's Cup. And also, but primarily just the travel restrictions just became increasingly tight, and it was impossible for people, someone, an individual to come over from England and work for a week at a time without having to do quarantine before and after. And so that was the primary thing. In the past, I've always tended to do around about 20 days a month consecutively, and then have somebody relieve me for about a week or 10 days at a time. And so the plan, that was always the plan. And even coming into January, I was really kind of just thinking, right, we'll see how it goes. As you know, we had Ryan Braemeyer who came in and sat in for a week in early December. And there was the option to have him come up in January. But really, it was just a case of once you're on a roll, the most difficult part of the job, being honest, was getting up in the morning and getting that first story done. And then once you're doing it, it's like doing the race. You know, you just keep going and keep going and keep on it.
Well, you're so knowledgeable on the race now, Andy. You could actually do your own Vendée Globe, surely. There isn't much you don't know about it. Were you aware?
I think I've forgotten more than I remember just now, but it's, you know, I did the end of the 2005 race, and then ever since then I've done each of the races at least for some part of it.
I know, for any aspiring sailor that wants to do future Vendée Globe races, you are a font of knowledge of what happens, what the sailors go through. You're well worth tapping into as a resource. Mm-hmm. Were you aware during this edition, I think more so than any other, of the growth that the international coverage was getting?
Do you know what, Dee? To be honest, I'd never really looked at it. I say the only real feedback I have was the people who took the time to find either the contact email address for the website or my own personal email. And I could tell that there was a growth there for sure. But I just didn't, I never wanted to put myself off thinking there's, you know, X thousand people out there listening. It was just, you like to just communicate with the skippers and the guests and keep it kind of a kind of intimate feel, if you like, and not be too concerned about who was out there listening, you know?
Yeah, I mean, we had, what were there, 9 nationalities in this race. So we definitely broadened the spectrum of interest. But I think, you know, you take a lot of credit for that. But I have to say, in previous editions, we've never had so many French skippers
speaking English.
I mean, what was the magic powder that you gave them to get them to talk to you?
To be honest, I think keeping it simple, keeping the questions simple and not trying to be too clever. But we were very fortunate with the likes of Damien Seguin, who is an international sailor, first and foremost. You know, he's done Paralympic sailing and international regattas for 20 years. And so he's used to traveling and he's used to speaking English. And he was very happy to do that. And others out there, you know, who increased, like Clarice Kramer, and Kevin Escoffi, both of them, for example, went to college or university in the States, and so their English is perfect. So they were great. But, I mean, Armel Tripon, who knew that he spoke good English? I don't think he particularly enjoyed it. I think he was happy to do it, but it wasn't something that he really looked forward to every day, I don't think.
Yeah, I can. It is hard. As somebody that's been on the receiving end, it's hard to do.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, correspondingly, we had Pip doing quite a few French vacations. You know, you empathise with her. You see how hard it is. Her French is fine, but she, you know, you add into the mix, you add the fact that the skippers are tired, stressed, and then having to speak a different language, then you suddenly realise that it's not so easy for the French skippers either.
Indeed. And you speak to the sailors every day, obviously not everybody every day, but it does allow you to build up a very special relationship with them.
Totally.
And I remember in 2008, speaking to you, I used to dread the vacations. I didn't know if I was going to be in French or English. And it's always that delay in satellite comms, and it made it really hard. And I didn't really know you, so I didn't react that well. Did it surprise you this year? Did you have any relationships that evolved with the skippers of people you didn't know?
I don't remember that at all about you, to be honest. I remember us having a good relationship latterly and having quite a few laughs. And I think the key thing for me about the whole job is being the conduit. You're only there to listen to what the skippers have to say. And ideally, you know, when they're down, give them a little bit of a lift and a little bit of encouragement and just keep telling them what a great job they're doing, you know. That's the fundamentals for me.
Yeah, I'm quite a visual person. So for me to be face to face with you at the end.
Yeah, no.
I remember you saying to, I think you said it to my team, of like, where's she been for the whole race? And it was like you were talking to a different person. So do you think the video technology that the skippers have access to now has helped the communication?
I think it has, but obviously the skippers don't see us. They don't have a visual of us at their end. They're still talking into a microphone or into their phone, you know.
Mm.
So we did that in the Barcelona race, if you remember. Then we had a different technology. And the problem is that technology is never perfect, you know. As you would see, you know, numerous times we had worse lines to people in England than we did to the Southern Ocean, you know.
I know. It shows how great the technology is getting, though.
Yeah, well, for sure. But I mean, and the other thing that we had in our favour this time, in terms of general communication, was WhatsApp, you know. And I think that's the next step for general communication, for being able to get information off the boat, almost instantaneously. And that was great from the writing point of view. You know, I would message Boris when I needed information at 6 o'clock in the morning to write a story. And Boris would ping it back to me immediately, just knowing exactly what I was looking for. And he'd just do like three 1 minute or 90 second audio files. And that was me away for the day. And it just sets you up for the day to know what's going out there during the night and what's going to be happening for the day. And that's part of the most important things.
Yeah. And what's difficult for you when you're talking to skippers? Is it knowing that it's the middle of the night for them, or they might have a problem, but you still have to speak to them? What are the difficulties you face?
The time delays. I certainly had a few difficult moments when we were waking skippers up in the middle of the night to do video calls, you know. That was pretty tough. And when skippers are stressed, that's hard work. But there's always the option for skippers to say no. And we did have that a few times. When it would, for example, Damien Sagan had a little bit of a blackout. He just said, right, I've had enough just now. I need to have 4 or 5 days just to kind of recalibrate, just to, get himself back to zero. And the same with Boris. You know, Boris had a period where he, and just because of the time difference coming into Cape Horn, he was just finding it hard because he still wanted to sleep when it was dark.
Yeah.
And that was when we would be waking him up. So these times were difficult. I have to say that, you know, it's hard to work to the regime or the protocols that Alex and his team work to, because they very much dictate what they want to do and when, and that doesn't always fit in with what the race want and when.
Yeah, you're balancing all 33 skippers, whereas they're just focusing on one.
That was the other big difference this time. Having had 33 skippers at the start, we still had 25 on the course, and your everything is just cut a little bit more thin all the way through the race. You know, you have less time for each skipper. We were doing more spare calls in the morning than ever before, and it just made it a little bit harder, and having less time to build that relationship and get the information from the skippers.
And thinking back, maybe think of this race in particular, and then maybe all the races that you've covered. What's been one of the more emotional stories for you to cover? What's affected you personally?
I think we kind of discussed this a little bit before, but for sure, Kevin Escoffey on this race was really, really hard to deal with. But having been through the 2008-09 race, when there was, there were so many more abandons, there was two life-critical situations that we came through. You kind of fall back on that as your defaults, if you like. But you were still going to bed at 1:30 in the morning, not knowing what was going to happen with Kevin Escoffier. So that was hard. But I mean, there's lots of little emotional things that just strike a chord at particular times. You know, when Pip was doing her press conference and she's saying, you know, I didn't cry at all during the race, but I could cry now just not knowing that my mum and dad couldn't come to the finish and all my friends and family couldn't come to the finish. And that was such an essential part of the race because, with respect, I don't think the French people here really appreciated that. They didn't really have an understanding of how hard it was for international skippers to be here without their friends and family. And you know, even tomorrow, Ari's only got a dozen people here when he might have had hundreds, you know? And it's a different thing.
Yeah. Well, one thing the French are very good at is coming out to support the homecomers, for sure. But I cried at Pip's comment when she said, you know, what's upset me most or what's really hard is my parents not being here. I choked at that point too.
Yeah, well, yeah, me too. Me too. And it was one of the moments where you just thought, okay, nobody's really thought of that. I know that it was hard for her at the start, but it was hard for everyone. But, you know, when you contrast Pip's, you know, finish with some of the French finishes when they've got all their friends and families and you know, we all loved to see Alexia the other day with her dog on the boat. It was fantastic. And again, you kind of choke at that. But, you know, that was with Pip. It wasn't there. You know, she had people coming in a little bit under the radar, shall we say, just to make sure that she could have people on the pontoon for her. But her race was worthy of hundreds of English people on the dock for her, you know?
For sure. And talking of Pip, did it surprise you with technology and everyone's demand for video and content and how popular the live shows were, that her written work was just as popular and in demand? Do you think there's still that demand for people to write their account of the race?
I think it's a personal thing, but I think, you know, first and foremost, Pip is a journalist, and that's where she's made, 30 or 40% of her income over the last 10 or 15 years. So she's a very accomplished writer in her own capacity. But I think she wanted to do that, but to have stuck to the discipline of doing it every day, I mean, all credit to her, and her writing was fantastic. But also, I have to say credit to our French redactors here who made sure it was translated every day. And that really contributed to, you know, Pip's popularity in France. You know, she's a big, big star in France and they all want to know what's next for Pip.
Yeah, and we're celebrating the fact that when you had her sponsor on, he openly talked about the next race, going shopping for a boat. What a great position to be in.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, obviously, it's abundantly clear that your passion for the Vendée Globe is obvious. But what do you think makes it stand out as the pinnacle event in our sport?
It's super simple, isn't it? It's one person, one boat, nonstop around the world. And, you know, I kind of had a little bit of a joke, if you like, with Pip and others that my mother-in-law is 78. She's not remotely interested in sailing. Well, she is a little bit. But she wasn't interested in it particularly because I was away, but she downloaded the app. And then every day, 6:30 in the morning, she'd get up with her cup of tea and she'd be onto the app and she'd be following it. And there was thousands of people like her who just got into the race because they could understand it. They could follow the tracking, they could follow the weather. And she was right into John Le Cam and, you know, she thought he was fantastic, even if she didn't really understand what he was saying half the time. So many different...
Well, even the French don't understand him half the time.
No, but so many different characters and so many different, adventures and happenings that it was... And the other thing that we know is that it was much more of a race through the entire fleet, all the way through. You know, it was only 10 days ago or 2 weeks ago that Ari kind of lost touch with Alexia. But otherwise, everybody's had a race all the way through, and that's been good for the skippers, but it's been good for the race.
Good for the sport as well, as you say.
Completely.
I mean, the conversation's been very prolific about foils, not foils. And Jean Le Cam kind of threw that whole argument into disarray by getting the result he did in an old non-foiling boat. You've been interacting with the boat captains and the engineers, the designers. Where do you sit on this discussion and what do you see the future of the race being?
I think that this was an exceptional race, as we all know, because of the different transition zones, the stopping and the starting, and particularly the big park up, if you like, in the Pacific, which let all the boats really compress again. I think under normal circumstances, you would have had the newer generation foilers out in front, and we wouldn't be having this discussion. But I think there will always be a place for the non-foiling boats as as a group of boats that will always have a good race, and it will always be a focus on them as well. You know, I don't think we're ever going to see just foiling boats in this race, because it's not in the nature of the race itself.
As you say, it's everybody. There's so many individual stories within the bigger race itself.
Yeah.
When we're looking at the foiling boats, so many of them were basically sailing incapacitated. So they never found the conditions to fulfill their potential, or they were restricted by having damage. So do we think that the kind of halfway house is the better place to be in, you know, just your opinion, having indulged in it so completely recently?
I think that you'll see in the next race that it will be the same, that the generation of boats that have done most racing and the most sailing and have been most optimized will still be in the top five or top six, and possibly, you know, still that generation of boats on the podium. So the newest boats in this race will for sure be among the top contenders next time round, assuming they've done most of the Globe Series.
So I see this winter's been so inspirational, having such a great race to follow, that I'm hoping it's inspired lots of future generations of people that want to do the Vendée Globe, not necessarily French, but, you know, international audience. I know what I want to hope the younger generation take away from this race. And I don't want to put words in your mouth, so I'll be really keen to know what you would hope they would take from this race, like how they get into it and stuff.
I think my advice constantly is about being realistic, and I think PIP is a great object lesson there in doing the race at a level and concentrating on pushing your known limits, if you like, but not setting your goals too high. You know, we have so many young or not so young, good level but not top level sailors who are saying, I want to do the Vendée Globe. I need a foiling boat, and my aspirations are to be in the top five, top ten. It's so much about building a program around the sailor's ability, and then communicating it really as best as they possibly can, and having some kind of USP, you know, having something that's unique that people can get a hold of and follow.
Yeah, I mean, we're on the same page there. My takeaway from it, or that I want to portray to people, is, as you say, you get lots of young Figaro sailors or young sailors of like, yeah, I want a new generation boat and I want to go out there and win. But here you go, Pip invested everything to make it happen. And what she's done is engaged a sponsor that now gives her an opportunity to go again in a much more competitive boat. So, you know, it's allowing them to realize they could do it for a smaller budget, with the potential for a much longer game rather than a one-hit wonder.
That's right. But I think the key thing, or the key question for me, and I'm sure for yourself, is it's the second race that's difficult. It's like the second album after you've had a hit, you know, if you're a band. It's knowing how to portray yourself in the second race, what your targets are, what boat you're going for. And you see, it's all about managing the expectations and being able to deliver the program all the way through. And you see that with the likes of Alan Rura in particular, stands out, where he's had a good budget, but he just hadn't done the races and hadn't done the training that some of the other guys at the front of the fleet had. And so he went out and he really struggled to start with because he was so far behind his expectations.
Yeah.
Stéphane de Raison, a little bit the same. And it's really, you really have to be able to put the whole program together and have some realistic idea when you start on the start line where you could be and should be finishing, you know, and not, you know, shooting for the moon.
Yeah, I mean, it's all good having aspirations, but you've got to have the delivery that backs it up. What I loved with Alan Rora's race was the fact that Pip was in his old boat ahead of him for a large portion of it.
No, completely, yeah. Yeah, but I mean, that's not good for his morale. It's good for Pip's, but not for him. Yeah. I think that really hurt him.
Understandable. And as you say, Sam Davies is another case in point. Race two, the disaster. Race three. Yeah. Was a different story. She actually went from, okay, the race is over, I've got a much bigger mission in my hands now. And to get back out there to do the whole South ahead of you is a big decision. But she came in having saved 102 children's lives.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it is fantastic. It is fantastic to see. But you also kind of question how close it is to the, you know, the fundamental of the Vendée Globe is nonstop. And were that charitable aspect not there, then you do kind of think, well, you know, because beyond that, you then start to encourage people to carry on, and that's what will happen. And I, is it good for the race? I'm kind of a little bit on the fence on that one.
Yeah, I think if we look at Isabel and Sam, Isabel had a transatlantic to get a boat home, and so her metaphorical finishing, completing the circle was important to her and she needed to get the boat home.
Completely.
But as you say, Sam was in Cape Town. She had the whole South ahead of her, but the drive was the charitable arm of saving children's lives.
Yeah, no, definitely. Definitely.
A discussion, I think, that could go round in circles and on and on, I think.
Absolutely.
So anticipating 4 years' time, Andy Robertson's not on the start line for the Vendée Globe, but he's there for the international media, single-handedly making it all happen. Do we think it's going to be bigger and better? Do you think the race has got the potential to keep growing at the rate it does?
I think in terms of the audience, I think it's almost unlimited, but there has to be certain aspects which improve for next time in terms of the resources that are placed in the international media, for sure. You know, it's been too hard in a lot of respects, and it deserves better, you know. And I think, but I understand and I respect why that is. You know, you and perhaps a wider audience lose sight of the fact that it's a race which is owned by a region of France, and so much of the return is about the political capital for that region. You know, it's about the region status within France. It's about the region's investment or government investment within France, and it's about the region's profile in France. And so many of the sponsors are French. The international aspect is not critical to the Vendée Globe, you know, and you have to understand that.
Yeah, I mean, you do a great job to piggyback off it. And actually, we're very grateful that their status is so strong. The fact that they had presidential acknowledgement when Macron spoke to Jean Le Cam after Kevin's rescue. And then the mayor had the ability to change the rules for the arrivals. I mean, that was critical to break the curfew. Made a big difference. And we do appreciate the power that it has.
No, for sure. And I think within France, obviously, It was a big step into the unknown, a big investment for the Vendée region to make sure that the race happened. But, you know, the returns and there were big concerns before the start because so many sponsors, like, for example, PRB and some of the sponsors who really, their return is as much about having people coming through the race village, hundreds of people coming through the race village before the start. That's where the return is, and these sponsors put a lot of pressure on the Vendée region to postpone the race for a year. And the Vendée region, the SEM Vendée, stuck with it, and I think they've been rewarded in within France and internationally with a great feeling all the way through their audience in these you know, difficult times.
Yeah, as you say, I mean, Sodebo can't get people to eat pasta and pizza without having people footfall through. But we're very grateful that it did happen because it distracted
Yeah. But that's that. You know, that's the same in France and around the world for sure. You know, it's you remember yourself. You see these the messages to the skippers as they go out the channel, and it's all about, you know, help us dream, let us dream, share the dream. And that's what the Vendée Globe's about to the audience. You know, that's what the skippers are out there doing. And I think that that message was heightened so much more this time.
For sure. Now, you have metaphorically gone around the world in your 120 odd days of commitment to this race. So I don't need to ask what's next, as in I imagine it would be reuniting with your wife and your dogs and maybe sleeping.
No, I've caught up on the sleep in the last 10 days or so, and it's fine. But certainly going back and going back to my family, we're moving house about 3 days after I get home. So that's a biggie.
Well, so Nina, I have a jobs list ready for you then.
Absolutely, yeah.
But the world's waking up. Restrictions seem to be lifting. Have you got plans for races and work that you're going to be doing?
Ideally, I'll be back in France for the La Solitaire again. I've done 8 solitaires back to back. I'm hoping to work in the Transat Jacques Vabre, but it's nothing's a given there. It's a whole new regime there. I normally work in the TP52 circuit, but we've just postponed the first 3 regattas of the year. So that means that circuit won't restart until July or August. So there's a lot of things still up in the air. And I think, you know, it's still going to be very difficult this year. And you know, the rest will be fine. I'll be quite happy to have a few months off now.
I can imagine. But it's good for us as an audience to know where we can hear your dulcet tones giving us the information we need.
I mean, I think, you know, we're talking about it today. I think there is a need to carry on with some kind of lives through, you know, do a Vendée Live once a month and just on Zoom or whatever, just to keep the audience informed. Because there's plenty of things happening. And, you know, one of the keys, as you'll appreciate, is that there's very definitely a message that if you want to be competitive in the next race, you have to get started as soon as possible. And, you know, we know this program's up and running for the next edition already. And skippers carrying on with the same programs. And so there's always news. There's always things happening in the Vendée world, and I think we need to be more attuned to doing you know, these kind of Vendée Live shows in the interim period.
Well, that's great news, because I know the next few weeks is all about boat shuffling. People purchase different boats, people get new boats, people exchange boats, and it'd just be great to follow that process to know who's getting what and when.
Yeah, no, for sure.
But all these people talking about boat shopping, we want to know where they're going.
Exactly. Well, it'll be interesting to see who's on the dock. Or I know for sure that Pip's coming back in a few days to France, and there's boat shopping, and there's a few others, and there's a few going after the same boats. So
yeah, it's critical.
I think the any investment in an Amoca 60, a good performing Amoca 60, I think is a good investment just now. And I'm sure, you know, you'll see that with Armel Tripon's boat, the boat he sailed, you know, that will not have lost any value at all. I think that's been a good investment. And they're building another boat for stock, which just gives you an indication of what the market's going to be like, which is incredible considering, you know, where we're supposed to be in terms of the world economy.
For sure. I mean, economics aside, I think Occitan en Provence was the first confirmed sale to Louis Burton. So
that's right.
I think, you know, that suddenly sparked everyone's realization that you need to be pretty quick. I know Charlie Enright, who's looking at the Imochas from the Volvo Ocean or the Ocean Race perspective, is getting his new boat launched in July. He'll have both boats racing during the summer, but ultimately he's going to want to sell his old boat, which was the former Hugo Boss that finished on the podium.
Yeah.
It wasn't allowed to take part in this race regardless, so I think that would be an interesting purchase for somebody as well.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think there's a few around, and it's a kind of musical chairs in a way. I think we'll we'll wait and see. You know, I think, for example, we're waiting to see what happens with Alex and his boat. And if Alex goes for a new boat or changes, for example, then Chiral will change. And it's interesting.
Yeah, so there's lots of content for the show, and we're delighted at that scoop that you've given Float Magazine here. You're going to do a Condé Live monthly?
No, no, so I don't think it's a scoop. It's just I'm certainly going to push for that as an idea, and we'll, and you know, that something has to happen. We can't just continue with just you know, doing the odd story on the website.
Well, perfect. Your international audience here will definitely support you on that.
Indeed.
Well, I'm not going to take up all your time because you're getting ready for the final finish. Great boat coming in with Ari Husseila.
Yeah.
Hopefully tomorrow. Do we know what time?
10 in the morning is what Ari says. And he does work to a schedule. He's a pilot. I mean,
okay.
And, you know, massive credit to Ari. I think, you know, we've been speaking to him a lot in the last few days. You know his background. He's never been out to be competitive in this race. It's about realizing the dream. And he's another one, a little bit like Miranda, he personally has got a big loan in the boat. I'm not 100% sure about the insurance in the boat, and he's 58. You know, he's not going to be doing the Vendée Globe again. And so the whole thing for him has been about getting around safely. He set himself his limits. And if he's a few days after the last boat, he's happy, you know. He's been fantastic through the whole race.
Yeah, no, we're cheer big time. And it really does kind of put the final curtain down on what's been an absolutely fabulous race. But actually, I think the hats off go to you creating an international, well, material for an international audience to enjoy and really indulge in. So thank you, Andy. Thank you for your time today. It's been great to put you on the receiving end of the questions for a change.
No, it's wonderful.
And allow people just a little chance to know what the man is behind the questions.
Thank you, Dee. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, and thank you from me as well, Andy. And it was really interesting listening to you both talking about the race, because this inside views and inside information for our audience is really, really interesting. So thank you very much, both Dee and Andy, for your time. And I think this is a really interesting episode of the Float Originals.
Float Originals. Hören, was auf dem Wasser bewegt.